right at last. Salutations from the other side. Well, I can see that you're the devil's bride. Do you realize that all of you donated something horrible you hated that was part of you? Well, I'm your nightmares coming true. I am your crime. Woo! Life at last. Sit and listen while the fun begins. Hearts are broken. Bad guy wins. Sit and listen, all the cutting up is easy, and it isn't for the queasy or the weak of heart. Well, you had better start the home while it's still time.
Never sing my music again. Not here, not anywhere. Do you understand? Never again. My music is for Phoenix. Only she can sing it. Anyone else that tries dies.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Pod Stallions. I am Brian, and with me to my left, my very far left, is Jason.
Hello, everyone.
And we are the number one podcast for a very loud computer fan. I'm very proud of that. We should both be patting ourselves on the back for that one.
Hey, that's a tough category.
It is. We sweeped it this year. I also want to point out that I actually replaced my computer fan about a year ago, and it actually seems like it's louder, like about the most silent computer fan ever made. And it, when I plugged it in, it didn't make a difference. So,
but oddly enough, also one of our most consistent fans of the show.
Yes. Oh, that was really a dad joke. So we thought we would do for the Halloween season just a mini episode right now, and then we have a longer episode planned. We just don't have the time to record that one right now. So what could we do that I could just fill the air? And that is to talk about one of my favorite movies of all time, and that is Brian De Palma's Phantom of the Paradise. Jason, I hope you're familiar with it.
I am indeed.
Yeah.
But not, I know it's one of your favorite things.
Yeah.
And I love so many of your favorite things, and so many of them I dig too, but I love your enthusiasm. So I think this is a great mini topic for sure.
Yeah, I saw this movie when I was about 7 or 8 years old. Probably shouldn't have been watching it, to be perfectly honest with you. And it was an older cousin who brought me into it. And it really left a tremendous impact on me. I just absolutely loved its style, its music, and its overall story and the characters. Like, it was a complete bomb when it came out, and now it's like a lot of things that were misunderstood at the time. It is considered an absolute classic, and I think one of the things,
and it was 1974.
1974, yeah. And
74, okay.
There's some really neat trivia about this film, like Swan's Building. I think the film is partially filmed in Texas or in Dallas, because the building Swan's Record Company is in, Swan Song, which was the original name of it, and then it had to change it because Led Zeppelin sued them, and they had to turn it into Death Records. And that's why the Death Record logo looks like it's floating a lot in the movie, because it's actually superimposed. And you can still see the swans. But anyways, the building that his record company is in is also in Logan's Run. It's the Sandman headquarters. Yeah.
Wow, that's like a double whammy for you.
Hmm. It's very nice. And
so you saw it, you must have seen it on television.
City
on
television.
Airing on
yeah.
television.
Yeah.
And what was your, because I think I saw it late one night. I'm trying to think of when. I mean, I think I knew it existed. I don't know how I would have, if maybe from a magazine or
yeah
something. But it was, I must have been, you know, 11 or 12 or something maybe. And I remember it late one night on local television and just sort of getting lost in it and not quite sure what it was. I knew who Paul Williams was at that point. He was a fixture, you know, by the late 70s for me. Maybe it was like 80 or 81 or something. But it was Beef. Garrett Graham,
just tour de force.
And we'll get to all those characters. But that was the bit that just kind of knocked me out.
Yeah.
That I just adored. And always associated it with them. The more I discovered about it, the more I knew about it. That was the part that elevated it to something else for me. That I just thought was, he comes in, I don't know where the motivation came from to behave the way he did, the choices that he made. You know more about it than I do.
I actually don't know a lot about why he chose to do Beef that way. I'm just so grateful he did.
Oh, it's just a thing of beauty.
It is.
It's brilliant.
I can't believe Garrett Graham isn't more famous.
You know, I was thinking that the other day. I was watching, as I do, I was watching Miami Vice. We've talked about Miami Vice before on the show, how I, and people say what you want, the first couple of seasons of Miami Vice, you know, was a groundbreaking, incredible show.
Very
and
stylish.
Looking back on, oh, just the music and how expensive it was and the time taken. I mean, each one was a movie. Nobody was doing television the way they were making these shows. And, of course, loads of faces, you know, pop up in this thing from, you know, Benicio del Toro to Giancarlo Esposito and, you know, Bob Balaban and, you know, all kinds. And Garrett Graham is in one. And he's kind of the comic relief doing, he's like a con man doing different voices and stuff. And then I thought of him in Used Cars. Remember Used Cars? The Zemeckis movie with, he's hilarious in that movie. And everything he did, he was 100%, you know, all the way. And I think the connection with De Palma, and I'm going off on a tangent here, is De Palma's, I want to say his second movie, was a movie called Greetings. And it was Garrett Graham, Robert De Niro, and a third guy who I've forgotten. And I think it's like 1967 or 68. They're like draft dodgers or something. I forget. It's been a long time. And he was in that ilk, Graham. Like, he was going to be, you know, he was going to be one of those guys, I think. And he always worked. He just never became a household name.
Yeah, he pops up in a lot of stuff, and you're just like, what a journeyman. Yeah. Like, he just never stops. But you're also like, why isn't he a bigger name? Because, you know, I think the thing that I remember him from in the 90s was he ended up on the cast of The Critic as John Lovitz's dad. And again, you know, what a perfect guy for animation, because he could do all these voices and these characters, and yet he didn't do a ton of animation either.
Yeah, he just was one of those guys that you were happy when you saw him. And I mean, I think he's still kicking.
He's still kicking.
But I'm gonna give it over to you. Phantom of the Paradise to me is one of those things that, you know, we've said this phrase about different movies and eras. They could only have happened when it did, I think.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that it's perfect for the era that it was made in, the music, the things that were popular at the time, the glam thing and so on. But give us the background on sort of how this, obviously Phantom of the Opera, but where the thing gestated from. Like how this happened? Because this would have been after Sisters.
Yeah,
probably did Sisters in 73. I think.
Yeah, and the Phantom himself, William Finley, is in Sisters. So
that's right. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. The film is
where did it kind of come?
I don't, you know, it's been a long time since I read up on it, but, you know, the film is a combination of not only the novel Phantom of the Opera, but Faust as well. And then there's, you know, a lot of different other elements in there. Obviously, like, Beef is kind of an homage to Frankenstein on the stage show.
Yep.
And we have, spoilers, picture of Dorian Gray, and that Swan is retaining his image to stay alive. Like, so he never ages. And I think basically when I think when De Palma got it going, he got Williams on early, if I recall correctly. Williams to do the music and then to play Swan. And that's where the film kind of took off, I think. And
it was for De Palma, it's a bit of a departure because it is kind of, it's not camp. I don't think I would use the word camp, but it's certainly
slightly fairy tale esque.
It's lighter. Lighter for him at that.
The scene I always think of when I think of that film where it kind of dips into weirdness is like the prison or the judge scene. You know, it's pretty straightforward into that part, and then you get into this kind of like cartoony judge, you know, life, you know, and then it kind of gets a little silly there, but I don't think it's ever meant to be real. It's meant as sort of a slightly fairy tale esque thing, and there's a lot going on in the movie personally, like the whole idea of the juicy fruits. And the way Swan's band just keeps changing genres is very sarcastic. And to add to that, Paul Williams is a really great songwriter. And, you know, you've got... I remember I sat with a musician, like a guy who had his own band and stuff, and I was really into Phantom in high school, where it was very easy to get, you know, merchandise and memorabilia because the film hadn't been really appreciated and was considered kind of dated at the time because, you know, the bell bottoms and the clothes and all that. And I remember talking to him, and he was one of the first few people who said, "I love that movie." And then he started citing the upholstery as being just the funniest parody of Beach Boys music he'd ever heard. You know, he's a carburetors, man. He thought that was so funny. And I realized that, like, the film had a real good sense of humor about itself in all aspects. So it's kind of a unicorn in that it's like a horror musical comedy that has lots of gore in it. You know, because De Palma... let the blood flow in this film like he did in all his films. And I don't know if you know this, but Brian De Palma's dad was a vet. So he was...
I did not.
And he had his veterinary shop in the house. So it was quite common to see blood all over the place in his growing up. So that sort of like has an effect on Brian De Palma. And, you know, I know I have some friends who abhor his filmmaking and others who think it's great. I like some of his work very much. Phantom being my favorite film by him.
Well, it is, when you look at the body of work, even, you know, just the 70s, like it's a strange concoction.
It is.
You know, in the best way.
And it didn't work. Because, in the grand scheme of things, because the public didn't like it, except in two places in the world.
Which were?
Paris, where it played forever. But, and this is the oddest one, Winnipeg, Manitoba. Massive hit in Winnipeg, Manitoba. And they have a Phantom Fest in Winnipeg to this day. I've always wanted to go. It's just that... you know, at one point they got the entire cast there for an airing. And they still have Phantom
Love
Fest,
that.
I
love how specific that is.
Yeah.
It
played there for months and was a massive hit. And it makes you wonder if it just didn't get the right, it didn't find its audience in other places because it wasn't marketed correctly. And it was marketed with two different ad campaigns. I have both posters, but I can't find them since the move. But the first one is a very beautiful piece of artwork that actually features on the soundtrack. And then the second one is a much more exploitation horror type cover. I think it's by Corbin, Richard Corbin. And, you know, it's got Winslow with a big purple scarred face holding a very busty swan or phoenix. You know, if you went in on that poster, you would have been seriously disappointed with the film itself.
Well, that would be the next thing. It was such a one-off. Like, well, let me ask this. Did Rocky Horror exist, the stage show, before Phantom of the Paradise?
As much as I'm fan of Rocky Horror, or Phantom of the Paradise, I'm not a fan of Rocky Horror. I don't know anything about it.
I'm just trying to think of what the signposts were for him to do, you know, a horror musical, slight comedy, you know, pastiche or whatever, because it really is, it's hard to categorize and market. I mean, I think I did see a making of at some point, and they were talking about the marketing and how nobody really knew what to do with it. Was it mauled, you know, when it came out? I know it didn't do much, but were the critics harsh when it came out?
Reception, you know, that is a good question. I'm going to look that up because I've never cared. I think I read the Leonard Maltin book. I think it got what you would be considered mixed reviews. You know? And again, like, it's the usual culprits I'm reading here. Like, Gene Siskel didn't like it. Well, he didn't like anything. And then Variety liked it. So it's just one of those things where it's definitely mixed.
I mean, when I came across, like, I didn't, again, you know, I think because of the magazines that we read, or the things that we were aware of, like, I knew who Brian De Palma was, and I think I kind of knew what his work was, but I don't know when I put together that was one of his movies. Like, it is just such an oddity. It's such a standout from everything else. Paul Williams, I mean, I know you're a huge Paul Williams guy, but
I am, but it's because of Phantom.
Paul Williams, for me, was one of those guys like a Roddy McDowall that just seemed to show up in everything. And, you know, I always liked watching him, you know, when I was a kid, because he was, I don't even know if I understood that he was, you know, the guy who wrote Rainbow Connection. And
I had
like
no
that.
Idea. I had no idea how, you know, he was famous. I just assumed he was an actor because he showed up in so many things.
Yeah, he was in a movie. You know the movie The Loved One?
Yeah, I've never seen it, but I know it.
Robert Morse and Jonathan Winters. And Paul Williams is in it when he's a kid, you know. And there was another thing that popped up late, local television or something. And here's a kid walking around where you go, that looks like Paul Williams, but Paul Williams always looks like a kid. Like, is that him? You know. And then the more he found out of his life that he was an actor, and then he starts goofing around on the guitar on the set of, like, Last Picture Show or something, and one thing leads to another, whatever. And so was he, by the time of Phantom of the Paradise, was he a fairly known?
I would say entity? So, because he was considered for a Bond villain.
Really?
Early
Which
on,
one?
Yeah. And you're the Bond expert, not me. But there's a Bond film. It's a Moore, and the two guys are there's two assassins who are supposed to be like a gay couple.
Oh. Wint and Kid.
Yeah,
Diamonds Are Forever.
Diamonds Forever. It was supposed to be Paul Williams. I think
no
they are.
Kidding.
I think the two guys are actual musicians. It's some sort of weird thing the director had.
Well, one of the guys is what's his name? Was Crispin Glover's dad?
Oh, Bruce Glover, right?
Bruce Glover.
Yeah. I think the other guy's a musician though, and they originally wanted Paul Williams. And I don't know how that didn't work out, if he was touring or what. But Williams was, you know, at that time, Williams was doing an awful lot of work. I mean, he was big with the Carpenters. He did this soundtrack. He did another film that I'm fascinated with and just recently saw, which is Bugsy Malone, which is another film that's just absolutely bizarre.
He did all the songs in Bugsy Malone?
Yeah, all the kids are singing with his voice, or, and this is another Phantom connection, you can hear Archie Hahn's voice. Archie Hahn's one of the Juicy Fruits in Phantom of the Paradise, and you can hear him singing in Bugsy Malone as well. I don't know if...
And Archie Hahn was like a fixture in everything, TV shows, movies, and stuff, and he's a big VO guy, right?
Yeah.
Big cartoon VO guy. And
he was also the original cast of Whose Line It Is Anyways, like the British cast.
Yes.
But he popped up in places, too. He's a lot like Garrett Graham, where he's not famous, but boy, did he get around, you know?
Yes, like every American sitcom, you know, or, you know, show of the 70s and early 80s, he was, you know, he popped up. And the other guy... The he's a British guy. The other he's part of the Juicy Fruits. Oh gosh.
Peter.
He was in the WKR.
Oh,
say again?
Yeah. Peter Ebling?
Maybe that's it. Yeah. He was the guy, he was in the WKRP episode with the punk band.
Scum of the Earth.
You know, they're called Scum of the Earth. Yeah, it's Michael DeBar and then this guy.
Okay, Michael DeBar, he's so famous to me because he's the snooty concierge in the BL episode of Seinfeld as well.
Yes, that's right. And took over for Robert Palmer in the Duran Duran spinoff band Power Station.
Oh, did he?
Robert Palmer did not. Well, Robert Palmer didn't want a tour. They wanted to, you know, capitalize on the record and tour, and Palmer said, no thanks. And then Michael DeBar stepped in and took vocals on that tour. And also, Power Station show up as the bar band in an episode of Miami Vice.
Ah, so look at what you did there.
And his ex-wife, blah, blah, the Pamela DeBar, dated Don Johnson. So Don Johnson was married to Melanie Griffith, very, very young, which is a whole other story, young she was when they started dating. But they were married, and when they split up, he started dating and living with Pamela DeBar, who was Michael DeBar's ex-wife.
Ah.
There you go.
Okay.
and there is Miami Vice trivia for the episode. There it is.
Yeah, I can't remember which actor... was in that, which Juicy Fruit is this? I want to say it's Peter Ebling. Elbing? That's probably
Dark
Peter Elbing.
Yeah, dark hair, kind of large teeth.
Yeah, that's...
You know, dark hair. Yeah.
He definitely, you know, I think Archie Hahn has the bigger presence, but yeah, you're right, it is Peter Elbing, the other guy, and I think he was the Scum of the Earth. Yeah, he was Blood. And it's hoodlum rock, not punk rock.
Little Rock, yeah.
The best scene is they're trashing the hotel room and Johnny Fever's just like reading a magazine, like nothing's happening.
Yeah, it's and they're all in suits.
Yeah,
they show up in suits and they seem proper, and then just all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, they're just that's the whole shtick.
This thing hit you probably in so many ways.
Oh yeah, it pushes a lot of buttons.
And
like I said, I didn't really become a big fan of it until I watched it again as a teenager. So I was like, oh, this movie. Because I couldn't remember its name when I was a kid. And I can honestly remember in grade 7 music class, we were talking about movies. And I went up to my teacher, who did not really like me all that much, my music teacher. And I think in front of the class, I was like, so what's that movie where the guy sells his soul to the devil? And blah, 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 blah. And... he could not want, like, you know, it's Catholic school, it's the early 80s, and he could not want to get off that topic as quicker. Like, I don't know. And it was very obvious that he didn't want to talk, because I opened with Satan. But I couldn't remember it. And then I happened to be watching TV probably 85, and it came on, and I just watched it right from the start to the end, and I was like, this is the greatest movie I've ever seen. And none of my friends, you know, at that time, you know, this was the home video revolution, and they were watching slasher films, and it wasn't a horror, and it wasn't funny for them, and it wasn't, you know, dated clothing, and it, you know, it didn't have any kind of sex in it. So my friends were just kind of like, I don't get what you see in this. But it was right. An absolute paradise to pick up the what little merchandise there was, you know, the albums and the posters and the what else was there? There's a novelization that's just weird.
Oh, really?
It's I don't even think the guy who wrote the novelization saw the film. There's just so much going on in that novel that has nothing to do with the film itself. Like, I think Winslow changes costumes several times. I didn't like the language in it. It's written by, I think it's written by a guy from, like, I want to say, like, Finland or something, or a Danish author. It's an interesting choice.
Did De Palma write the movie?
Pardon?
De Palma wrote the movie as well, right?
I believe he did, yes. Yeah, I'm going to double check that because it's been so long since I looked this up, but I think so. Yeah, it's written by Brian De Palma. I thought it was. It's beautifully narrated in the opening by your hero Rod Serling.
Yeah.
And
that puts it over the top.
William Finley didn't go on to much, but he's perfect as the Phantom. He's absolutely amazing. He did end up in some like smaller production. I think he's in a Chuck Norris movie. It didn't, you know, Phantom didn't really open doors for him.
And he was a guy that sort of, he had known De Palma from, what was his deal? Like was he either a tech guy or he did something else and then De Palma said, well, you should be on camera sort of thing. Or was he an actor from day one?
I'm not 100% sure of, like, if he's an actor from day one or not, but he had these wonderful early relationships with De Palma, because he was in Sisters, and then I guess his next big thing, and that's the only, I've not seen all these films, but I have seen The Funhouse, he had a relationship with Toby Hooper as well. In fact, I watched The Funhouse just to see William Finley.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, he ended up not having a ton of screen credits. And one of the saddest things I was told was my friend works with Guillermo del Toro. And Guillermo had gotten a hold of William Finley's email address and sent him a really nice note saying, you know, you were such a huge influence to me. I am such a fan. And, you know, I'm a film director because of, you know, your contributions, blah, 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 blah. I don't know the contents. But the reply he got was, thank you for this note. William died last night.
I remember you telling the story.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So that was, that's always a bittersweet thing. You know, I think he did, you know, live to see the appreciation for the film. Especially through those Phantom Fests and different film fests, but it's a shame he didn't get more accolade for that and better roles. But it is what it is, and of course Jessica Harper went on to make a couple of cult films actually after this. She made the amazing Suspiria which I just watched recently. I actually watched it this week. And then, of course, she was in the sequel to the Rocky Horror Picture Show, a film called Shock Treatment that I really can't stand. And I'm just trying to think. She got around. She actually, I love the story that she did Suspiria by passing on Annie Hall.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She's interviewed about it in the making of or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And
I didn't know she was in Shock Treatment. That makes sense. That she Shock Treatment gives, you know, the connection to Phantom. So when did Phantom sort of when did it sort of surface as like people started to appreciate it and knew what it was and kind of it got a second wind? Well, I never had a first wind, but like it sort of.
I think those that liked it a lot. And I used to, like, when I would go into movie poster conventions or, you know, memorabilia shops, you'd find people who go, oh, that's like, that movie's awesome. So it always had, I just don't think it had the exposure it needed. You know, it was one of those things that slowly caught on through TV repeats and home video and that sort of thing. And the cult sort of grew as the years droned on. You know, and of course now, you know, it's referenced, and there was a time, I remember in 89 when Andrew Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera was so popular that it was actually trying to be done as a Broadway musical.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I read that in Starlog.
Well, but see, it is, and hey, if Starlog didn't know what was going on, then nobody could get the scoop. But it is one of those things. It's like it's such a strange hybrid of things.
It is.
You know, how do you market something like that? It's not like there was a lot to sort of compare it with at the time, and it's a strange idea. Not redoing Phantom of the Opera or even the Faust thing, but the way it was done, sort of.
Yeah, it's a rock opera, and it covers so many different genres. You know, it begins with the 50s nostalgia wave, and then they move into this Beach Boy sound, and then, you know, Swan jumps to this sort of, like, I would say, very Alice Cooper-inspired goth rock for the final act. And as you said, they hire this... You know, with Winslow's Stolen Music, they hire this man to sing it, which was not supposed to be, and they hire this guy named Beef, who's all macho and scary and tough, and Garrett Graham just makes him the gayest man in the world.
I don't know where the idea came from to play him like that, but I think you see him singing first in the movie, right?
Yeah. He comes out and he sings a song, real butch, and then when they introduce him, he's growling at the at the press, and they do this like, you know, and then when he's just standing on stage, he's himself, and you know, he's as they say, he's very fey, he's very effeminate.
Just brilliant.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant, and it was. And if it would ever come up on a repeat, I would wait for him. He was the thing that I loved the most about it.
What really made me laugh was, for years and years and years, I would look at the film on an old television. Like, I had a VHS of the movie. And I think around 2000, my friend Sean and I, we went to go see it at the Royal Cinema. Or no, the Bloor Cinema. It was playing one night only kind of thing. We had missed the 35mm print of it that Del Toro did. So we went and saw it, and you could see things I didn't know. And the one thing that really made me laugh on the big screen was, I for years thought that Beef had a picture of like his mother on the wall, and no, it's a picture of himself, which always made me laugh.
Well, that whole thing to me was riffing on, you know, the glam.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
The tail end of glam, and, you know, the Alice Cooper stuff, and the, you know, I mean, I guess there were things, I mean, I don't know if Rocky Horror was a thing that, if the show existed, before, you know, the movie was, I think, 75 or something.
Yeah, it probably existed.
Oh,
then.
Shit. You know?
Yes, yeah, but they weren't like that big in 74.
So this was 74, right?
Yeah.
You said? So,
yeah.
So Tommy as an album, The Who, you know, Tommy as an album and as a touring show when they did, you know, live shows, you know, that was 69 and then into like the early 70s. The movie, Tommy, wasn't even until 75, which is, you know, pure musical, like no dialogue. So it's one of these things, there's not even a lot to sort of point to around it that sort of you know, seem like it, or it's in this particular genre. It's a real hybrid of things.
Yeah,
and
there's nothing. There's no real like other. I guess you could compare it with Rocky Horror, but Rocky Horror has so many other things going on in there, subtones and things like that. It doesn't quite work.
Right.
You know,
I'm saying at the time there really would have been nothing to compare it with.
No.
To try to
help and it people. Never and, really did become that midnight movie that Rocky Horror did.
Right.
Just in very small areas, but not to the grand scheme where like Rocky Horror became this thing you had to go do.
Right.
I mean, I had to do it in the 90s. I'm not that fond of it. No offense to those that like it. It just, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because I had to do it.
Yeah. Other than the tie-ins that were out when the movie came out, since, there's been, I want to say, like a Medicom 12-inch figure and a mask or something?
I don't know about the mask. Medicom did two 12-inch figures. This was how much I wanted this to happen. There was a local store called the Comic Post in Toronto. He used to get Medicoms imported from somewhere. But you had to pay in advance, I think, to get them.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, money was tight. I was just out of college when that came out, and I just walked up with like $120 balled up and like bat Phantom. And so I still have that Phantom. And I rarely do this. I'm rarely this guy. You know this about me. But there's things on that figure that really bug me.
Yeah, you know, I think I remember that.
He's got little loafers instead of boots, which are very plainly seen in the film. He's wearing motorcycle boots, and the face paint. And then about, I'd say 10 years ago, it must have sold so well that they reissued him. And, this is a more accurate version. And while it was, I didn't really think it was any much of, like, for the money, I didn't think it was a stretch. Since then, Medicom has released recently, I think last year, they released a little vinyl of Winslow, which I bought, sight unseen. Yeah. I think it came out I can't remember. I ordered it from Japan and the guy said, well, you'll get it in 6 months. And I was like, oh, like I paid in advance again. But, you know, and it was like one of those things where your eBay feedback would be useless. This guy could just rip me off. But to his credit, he sent me it eventually. I can't remember what it's called. It cost me like $60, I think. And I don't know about replica helmets. I have one.
I thought there was a mask for helmet or something. Maybe I'm getting mixed up with something else.
They've done some interesting stuff like pins, and I have a lighter that says Death Records on it. I think some of this stuff is bootleg. And I've always wanted to do
bootleg.
Pardon?
The thing that pops. Speaking of bootleg, the thing that pops into my head immediately is, you know, custom 8-inch figures of this. Have you ever done, or is anyone you know? Like,
no, Sean and I have always wanted to do 8-inch Swan and Winslow, and we just never got. We just haven't gotten around to it. We have all these, you know, these schemes and plans. Like we were gonna do Sean Connery as Zardoz 8-inch figures, and you know, it'll happen. But I think we'll both have to be like retired to make it happen. I'm just looking. The other thing I forgot to mention, looking on eBay, is that Medicom did this thing called Bear Brick, where it's like a Lego.
Oh yeah.
Bear thing, yeah. And that was an easy pass for me. Now they go for like $150. No thank you. But
listen, if you're gonna do an 8-inch Connery Zardoz figure, you better hit the hobby shop for like yak hair or something.
Crepe hair. Yeah. Well, what I was gonna do is I was just gonna spray glue on it and then shave over every one. You know?
With real hair action on the Zardoz.
And by the way, I'm one of those human beings where I can't look at Sean Connery without doing an impersonation of him somehow. You know?
Right.
It's so fun to do Sean Connery. Sean Connery and Michael Caine are kind of fun people to imitate.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. But Zardoz is one that rarely gets name checked. If only for the, you know, how ludicrous the...
And we should do a Zardoz episode.
We should do a Zardoz episode because it's completely insane.
Yeah.
It's a completely insane thing. You know, a strange departure for the director, the idea, the concepts, all of it. It's a real odd one. But yeah, I'm surprised that you haven't done custom 8-inch figures of this.
I just haven't. It has to be done well, and it will be someday. The other thing I wanted to point is because you want to make the helmet kind of come off somehow. The other thing I want to point out is, as much as I love the film and I think Paul Williams is great, I've always wondered what this movie would be like if they cast David Bowie as Swan.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the only other actor I could picture as Swan. I think it would have been very interesting considering Bowie didn't age and had a bit of a haunting. You know, I look at the, even though I'm not a big fan of Labyrinth, I look at the Goblin King in Labyrinth and think, he could have pulled off Swan really good. And my daughter, I've made my daughter a huge Phantom fan. And there is a Phantom of the Paradise shrine in my house. I have the Blacklight poster. And I've been painting portraits of the characters for years. And I'll share all this on the Pod Stallions page somewhere. And I have somebody gifted me a replica helmet. So I have a lot of Phantom stuff around the house. Including I have like vintage t-shirts and stuff like that. But... She when I told her that theory, she kind of went, "Oh wow, that would have been really neat," you know.
Yeah, you know. In fact, speaking of such things, this came up in a conversation not long ago. I remember this being rumored way back, and I don't know how far it got, but that for the '89 Batman, I think Bowie had been approached for the Joker.
Huh. Again,
at some point.
That makes a lot of sense because didn't at the time Frank Miller base the Joker on Bowie for his Dark Knight Returns?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah. So
which would have been a trip. What, yeah.
So this is one of my absolute favorite films. I love everything about it. I love how it ends. Personally, it's a bit of a downer, which is a very 70s ending to a film. You know, because not only does Swan die, Phoenix is saved from assassination, but of course Winslow dies as well. And I think the saddest part of the film for me, and the thing I really love about it, is he's reaching for Phoenix. She's horrified. He drops dead, and she recognizes him. So it doesn't even really have a happy ending in that regard.
It's a metaphor for life right there.
Yes, yes.
Does she do her own singing in the movie, Jessica?
I want to say yes.
Okay.
I don't think Finley does, even though the guy who does the singing in Phantom sounds just like William Finley. But if I'm not mistaken, he doesn't. Not William Finley singing. It might actually be Archie Hahn. I'm not sure now. Now you've got me. This is fun. Because you've got my brain going.
This was 74. And then after this, the next thing De Palma did would have been...
Carrie.
Which is kind of incredible when you think about it. Here's this movie that didn't really do any business and... You know, was a strange concoction. The next thing he does is huge.
Who the film's set dresser was?
I think I did at one point, but it's not ringing a bell. Who?
It's Sissy Spacek.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
I did know that. I think I either saw it in the credits or in the documentary, in the making of thing.
Okay, I've just decided to look things up to be a little more accurate. The novelization of the film was by a guy named Bjarne Rostang.
And I love Bjarne.
Yeah, oh yeah, I've got all his work. It was based on an early draft of the screenplay, and it excluded all the supernatural elements. That's why that book is so weird. I read that as a teenager, and I was like, did this guy see the movie? So it has been released in several different formats over the years. I think it's not one of those movies that's ever not been released on a home video platform.
Well, I've maybe got the Blu-ray. There was a Blu-ray that came out like a few years ago.
It's glorious. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so great. Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. But yeah, I hope that you folks will check it out during this October season. I watched it last year on my deck. We have a projector and watch movies. And every Halloween we put on a bunch of films, and Phantom won last year. So it is well worth a review, and it has aged terribly well, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's kind of a thing of beauty. I don't.
Yeah.
I really love it. I don't love it the way you do, obviously, but it's one of those things that I'm glad exists, and I think is kind of a secret handshake when you meet people and
cool
bring it
people.
Up. Cool people. Yeah. It's kind of true. It's really a, you know.
It's definitely one of those things. Like, I have a Young Ones t-shirt that I wear around town, and it's meant to look like a Sex Pistols t-shirt. So most people go, what band is that? Or, you know.
Right.
But if somebody comes up to me and goes, that's awesome, I usually think they're cool.
Yeah.
And Phantom's sort of like that for me as well.
You know? Yeah, and that's just who we are.
I remember the first time I went over to my neighbor's house, I was wearing my Death Records shirt, and my neighbor got it. You know, he's like, I know what
that's a deep cut right there.
Yeah.
You know, if you recognize the label. And I love that, too. That's that little aspect you mentioned that I just love, that there's a connection to Led Zeppelin.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, it's a lawsuit.
That strange little tie-in there to Zeppelin, I just love about that.
Yeah, yeah. They got sued a lot. They got sued for the comic character, the Phantom. Somebody else sued about use of the Phantom of the Opera. Like, there's a lot of lawsuits. I'm surprised that Hitchcock didn't sue her, because De Palma had to throw a Hitchcock parody in there with the scene from Psycho and the plunger.
Should have sued him for everything he did. Every freaking thing he did was practically Hitchcock. Yeah. But I'm going to fire it up this month for Halloween. That was one of our little Halloween. That's a mini Halloween for everybody. Yeah.
Look, for a longer episode, we have a real treat in store for you, where we're going to just sit and... You want to just reveal it?
Sure.
Why not? We're going to sit and talk about the works of John Carpenter this month.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah.
And then after that, the Carpenters.
The Carpenters. Yeah, we'll segue into that, which will again bring us back to Paul Williams.
Exactly.
The last thing I just want to mention about Paul Williams is he is one of the very few actors in this world that when you're watching him in Planet of the Apes makeup, even as a child, you're like, that's Paul Williams.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He is a unique, magical person.
Yes.
In so many ways. That he's had
the chance. I can't for the life of me get him to retweet me.
Oh, well, I'll make some calls.
Yeah, please do.
All right. Well, there you go, folks.
Thanks, folks. We'll talk to you again this month. Take care.
Take care.